the Access the Inaccessible podcast from Petzl with your host, Tom Livingston.
Hello and welcome to the Access the Inaccessible podcast from Petzl. I'm your host, Tom Livingstone. Today we're taking you to the mountains. We'll go to wild places and distant peaks, all with a camera and an eye for art. This can only be Ben Tibbetts, my guest for this show. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Tom.
Thank you very much for joining me. So I'd like to talk to you about what has brought you into being here in Chamonix, producing books on the mountains. So can you tell me what your average week looks like at the moment? How on earth are you the author of so many great books and climbing in the mountains so much?
Wow, just a little question to get started then.
Yeah.
So, obviously doing a lot of different things that kind of all pull me in different directions, which means I'm a master of nothing and kind of reasonably good across various disciplines. So,
well, what do you enjoy most? Where are your disciplines? What are your disciplines?
So we're in the middle of winter now. In the winter, I do a lot of ski touring and ski mountaineering. In the spring, maybe a bit more mixed climbing and rock climbing. More and more rock climbing. Well, through the winter, quite a bit of training indoors. Through spring, hoping to get more outdoors, and then summer, a lot of alpinism, and then through the autumn, yeah, more rock climbing, paragliding, and I guess a constant throughout the year, I actually do a lot of cycling as training. So most of my cardio training in the winter will be ski touring or just skinning up pistes a lot of the time, and then as soon as it's warm enough, I'll be doing quite a lot of mountain biking just on local loops. I don't do a whole lot of running because I feel the mountains do a fair job of trashing my knees anyway. So I don't.
You were joking earlier about being in a wheelchair. You're still very active.
Yeah, not in a wheelchair yet, but gotta look after this limited cartilage resource. Yeah, so an average week. There is no average week, but if let's look the last 2 weeks, for instance. So this time last week, I went to Aosta with Valentin and Dougal Tavner, Valentin, my partner, and we did a ski mountaineering shoot for Montaigne. So I scoped out a bivouac that I hadn't been to on a mountain that I have been to on a mountain bike before, Mont Falaire, just above Aosta. I found a beautiful recently constructed bivouac that I figured there hopefully wouldn't be anyone at in the middle of winter, and I was right. Tiny little bivouac, very well insulated, beautiful location, view over Gran Paradiso, Routor, Montemilius.
And we can come on to the bivouacs again a little later,
but yeah.
They seem to be, certainly in the last few years, these very impressive, quite beautiful small structures in the mountains. These little bivouacs. I think this seems to be a new age thing. Instead of them being a tin can, they're these interesting shapes or interesting locations.
Yeah, especially in Italy. Italy is kind of the kingdom of the bivouac.
Kingdom style as well.
Yeah, and coffee. So I do spend an awful lot of time in Italy. And yeah, a kind of thread that's running through my work. I guess the sort of previous 10 years, I was spending a lot of time on 4,000 meter peaks, trying to climb as many routes in various directions as possible. I've done a lot of what I want to do on 4,000 meter peaks. I'm just working on the eastern volume of the guidebook that I published, the western volume last year. But now the kind of thread that's running through my motivation and my work are these little bivouacs, the kind of little jewels of architecture that are scattered across the high alpine these days. And I'm interested in them in and of themselves, but they're also an interesting way that I use to structure what I want to do. So I have very broad interests from alpinism, classic alpinism on ridges, mixed climbing on faces, some steep skiing, some very traditional ski touring, some hiking, some mountain biking, and
that's a lot of activities there.
It's a lot of activities. Keeps me busy.
Yeah.
I guess the thread running through everything is that I find I get more out of a day if I'm taking photos. It helps me see more and helps me tell a story through the camera, and then I take a lot of like copious notes each night, and that, I guess, these stories are a way of sharing my experiences. I'm getting really mixed up here. This will need a bit of an edit. So the bivouacs are like a thread whereby different times of the year, I want to do a different activity. Like there's not every day that mixed lines are in condition, and it's not every day that you can go ski touring. And so I like to keep kind of busy and motivated and taking photos and telling and finding stories and having adventures all year round. And I found that using these huts as the kind of focal point, the kind of thread mm-hmm. that holds together all these adventures, I can see what the weather suggests is good, what the snow conditions suggest is a good thing to do in a certain time. And then because there's so many bivouacs, there's bivouacs like everywhere, like just the Val d'Aosta is like 80. There's some bivouac from which to base an adventure for whatever weather conditions present themselves. And so for me, they're really a vehicle or an excuse to go have an adventure, and then I'm doubly motivated because if I get good photos, then it can be a chapter in the book that I'm working on. So to come back to kind of this a week or 2 weeks of what I do. So yeah, last week I did the shoot, went to a bivouac, and so I got a really nice set of photos for Montaigne, who wanted to shoot a new jacket and a down jacket. And so we managed to get photos on a ridge, photos doing some steep skiing, photos on ski touring. And then I spent the next 2 days on the computer writing it up and editing the photos, which are useful for them, and they're also useful for me because I've now edited it into a chapter of the book that I'm working on, mm-hmm. hoping to finish in the next month or so. You know, that took up half a week. Then I'll do a little sort of some indoor climbing training in between all those, then go for a little bit of ski touring up the piece to keep fit. And then through the weekend, just did a personal adventure with Valentin. We went and ski toured up Mont Charvin, which is in the Araby. A peak I've seen lots of times, always fancied going up. It was the right time and moment. Took the camera. You know, it won't be nothing groundbreaking. It was just a ski tour, but it's good training and it's beautiful, and got some nice shots of the west face of Mont Blanc. Then I had a rest day, which was 14 days on the computer working on my book. People tell me it's not very good rest day, but it's the best I can manage. And then the last 2 days, Monday I was out with Victor and Mick, Victor Saunders and Mick Fowler, getting some film footage for Victor's son Hugo, who made a film of the last few years about Victor, but wanted to get some footage to make a new ending to the film, relating their recent ascent in Pakistan, which was quite groundbreaking, especially if you're over 70. Kind of remarkable.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, a good role model for us all. So yeah, I think that was a very good introduction to the broad range, the enormous range of activities that you do, the enormous amount of things that you do, and the enormous ways that you do those things. So not only are you a photographer and an artist and a climber in every sense of the word, but then you're also sort of in the classic sense, a mountaineer or an alpinist, and you're also an author of several books. So that's a lot of things. That is an incredible snapshot over the last 2 weeks, for example, of all those different things that you've been doing. Have you ever thought that's a lot of stuff?
Yes. I guess that kind of leads to the difference to you and me if we want to put it concretely, you're somewhat more focused, quite a lot more focused, on right now getting good at rock climbing and a couple of times a year doing something pretty gnarly on the killer face at high altitude, which it is an active choice on your behalf to get really good at quite specific disciplines. And I wouldn't say mine's an active choice to not be very good at any specific disciplines. It's more...
Well, you are very good at many, many things.
I guess my focus has been to try and get the best photos that I can of the things I love, mm-hmm. and of the places I love, and trying to develop a very strong and intimate relationship with landscapes across the Alps. And the focus on the photography and storytelling has the consequence of that is I'm spread rather thin to have enough time to, you know, put in 15 hours training on a Beastmaker or on the Kilter board. Mm-hmm. And so, and I don't rest enough. Yeah, so I'm constantly sort of half overtrained and scattered between big thighs from skiing and weedy little fingers from not training enough and a weedy little head from not doing enough full practice, and then being moderately good at paragliding. Well, no, in current standards, very bad at paragliding, but good enough to get myself into trouble, not good enough to take off from a serious place when you really want to be able to get down.
Well, you're being very British there, and to flip that on its head, that does mean that you can go to almost anywhere and do almost anything. How closely is photography linked to your adventures then? It seems very closely. Whenever you go outside, you take a camera, is that right?
Yeah. Basically, I find that if I get good photos on a day, it doubles my pleasure. So if we go mixed climbing and we do a really nice route together, that would be super fun. If we go mixed climbing, do a nice route together, and I get some nice photos, that'll be a lot more fun. I find it like profoundly rewarding in a way that I know most people don't. I know it's slightly odd. Flip it on its head, if we went mixed climbing and or a ridge, for instance, because ridges are much easier to photograph than a steep mixed climb. If we went and climbed a ridge and we were on it at sunrise, and if I didn't bring my camera, but that's unthinkable. Imagine my camera broke and there's this like just blindingly good photo at sunrise and my camera was broken. Even if we were having an amazing time, I'd be really upset. It'd be like crushing my soul if I could see a blindingly good photo and I couldn't take it.
So we've both found your nightmare situation,
yes.
But also your perfect situation. So
yeah, my perfect situation is we get up at 2 a.m. and we're on a ridge at sunrise and we're having fun rambling along some moderate terrain that's moving pretty fast. And so the fact that I've got a sort of 4 kilos of camera equipment isn't really hindering us. And we get a bunch of photos. At the moment, I do less at the really high end because one, you move a lot slower, so you get a lot less photos. Two, having that camera equipment means that I'm vastly incapacitated. And so, you know, above about 6B or something, it gets pretty annoying to have, even if I don't take a spare lens, if I've just got one lens, the body plus the holster plus the lens is probably getting nearly 2 kilos, is a pretty big handicap for climbing moderate rock climbs, which is why I spend a lot of time on easier ground, because you move more fluidly and so I get more photos. So yeah, so to come back to it all, getting nice photos, getting beautiful photos that speak to people really motivates me.
And where did that climbing and photography come from? Was it always one and the same, or have you started taking your camera more and more and enjoyed that?
Yeah, it's kind of always been one and together. I started climbing reasonably late in life nowadays, because gyms didn't exist that much 20 plus years ago. So I started climbing with friends when I was at university in Edinburgh. I think I climbed maybe a couple of times as a kid, but yeah, got into it at Edinburgh when I was also at art school and getting into photography, studying art. And so the two kind of developed slowly side by side. Like, I didn't get in any way good at rock climbing very fast at all, and I didn't get very good at photography very fast at all. They both took quite a gestation period, I guess. Because I was doing a lot of drawing and painting, actually. I guess I did.
Busy at school?
Yeah, I was busy at school studying like early Renaissance tempera painting and then the Enlightenment period and, yeah, all kinds of things that don't really advance one very far in life.
We can do a sub-episode on those.
Yeah, let's not. I guess it came together more. I started working as a mountain bike leader and a mountain leader and doing my MIA and winter ML, etc., etc. And then I went to Switzerland to do a postgraduate in 2007-8-9, living in Geneva. And then I guess that's when I got into the Alps a lot more. And that's both when my photography developed and when my aspirations went from Scottish climbing summer and winter, which is beautiful and amazing, but the weather is just so challenging that it's hard to get a lot done, however psyched you are. Whereas moving to the Alps, there's just so much more clement weather to go get stuff done. And so the two kind of combined to me taking a bigger camera along with me, doing a lot more climbing, and little by little, yeah, getting a little bit better. And then I went to the Antarctic for 2 years with the British Antarctic Survey. It's also a technological epoch, because that was the time when the first really good and accessible digital SLRs came out. So I think it's probably 2008 that the kind of the classic Canon 5D Mark II came out, which I had one of those for a couple of years. You know, by modern standards, the sensor's pretty rubbish, but it was remarkable back then. And so I took that to the Antarctic, and that was when I exploded from shooting slide film and shooting most of my studies. I shot with a medium format Bronica, like a 6x6 centimeter negatives, and then a 5x4 inch large format camera. And I remember having a discussion with Cubby, with Dave Cuthbertson, and I was adamant back in like 2006. I was like, the dynamic range of black and white digital, it'll never get to black and white film. And that was wrong. I was very wrong. And like a few years later, digital totally wiped the floor with what you could achieve with black and white film. And so I took down to the Antarctic. I actually took a 5x4 plate camera and my medium format kit, and then this DSLR. And I think I took 25,000 shots on the digital, and then maybe 6 frames of 5x4 over 18 months. And now looking back, I'm like, in a year and a half, I only took like 25,000 photos. Nowadays, I can take that in a month quite easily. But it totally revolutionized how I could think about photographing action, going from like a 36 roll of slide film on your little camera, or even more cumbersome working with a medium or large format. So yeah, the technology really played a massive part. And I look back at adventure and climbing photographers that worked in the decades before me, and I'm like, wow. A lot of their shots don't really hold up to the test of time, and you have to kind of make a mental effort to realize that, like, you know, they could only shoot like 36 shots before changing the film, and it just, like, you're like, wow, that's really hardcore to do that in, you know, like some of Marco Pretzel's early work. He was like on the killer face taking a few shots and then changing film at like 7,000 meters while he was like half dying. You're like, oh my god. And so you look back at some of that work, you're like, wow, It's freaking legendary.
But I would guess if you were 10 years earlier, for example, I think that could be you too. Don't you think your passion for photography would be constrained, of course, by the inconvenience of those ways, but you would still be doing it. You would still be there.
Wait a second, I'm just going to change.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I would have, but the results now, they come so much easier, which there's pros and cons to that. The con, obviously, is that everyone can take a really quite good photo. And so we've gone from a kind of epoch-turning event in about 2010 when sort of semi-pros all got really powerful cameras, and then 5 years later, like, the whole world had them. It's hard to keep your head above the parapet. It's hard to make a photo that truly stands out now because there's just so many amazing photos. And I don't have a solution to that. I'm just badgering away at doing my adventures and taking, you know, each year roughly like a crazy amount of photos. I think sort of between 100 and 200,000 a year. And over, I kind of average about 10 trips a month, 10 maybe sort of, yeah, 1 or 2 day or 3 day trips per month. It's a bit less in the autumn and more in the summer, but yeah, it's a numbers game as well. Like, you take that many photos, there's got to be some good ones, right?
You would hope so. Yeah. And so the results of this boundless energy is books like Alpenglow, your first book, is that right?
Yep.
So that was focusing on the 4,000 meter peaks of the Alps. And from there, you've recently released a second book.
Yep. The, again, 4,000 meter peaks of the Alps, but this time in a guidebook format. Yeah.
And that was the west side.
That's the west side.
With the east side coming in the future.
Yep.
And then as a side project, focusing on these bivvy huts, which
side project. It's just a 10,000-hour side project. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Side project.
Yeah.
So like M8 on 8,000 meter peak, that's a side project for you, yeah?
No. It seems like these things are all rolling nicely. It's a sort of virtuous circle where one feeds into the other. Is that conscious?
It is and it isn't. So, yes, it kind of is. So I guess didn't do any guiding the last 2 weeks. Before that, I did a little bit of guiding. I tend to try and organize my time because once time's rather limited, I'm very conscious that if you mess around, then you don't get anything done. And so I'll agree to guide people if they're interested in the same kind of things as me, as in fairly esoteric climbs that are in a wild and wonderful corner of the Alps that I probably haven't visited to before and possibly have a bivouac involved. And the same for a photography commission. Obviously, you know, if somebody tells me, look, I want to do this really novel thing, I want to do an alpine shoot for a Gore-Tex on the Cosmeeks Ridge, then I'll be just like, yeah, okay, I can do that, sir. But if they give me free rein, then I'll probably be in the Ekran or the Mercantour or the Dolomites or the Ortler on a route that nobody's ever heard of. And so I try and kind of steer everything into the same direction. Otherwise, I'm never going to finish this book, or this book will probably be several books. This kind of survey of alpine bivouac huts and all the world and wonderful adventures one could do. And so the photo shoots might be for ski touring, they might be for trekking, they might be for alpine climbing or rock climbing. I've done so much research across the Alps. There's basically a time and a place and a hut that I can coordinate pretty much anything into one of the routes I've researched that has a bivouac involved. And so the bivouacs, they're kind of an excuse, but they're an excuse to allow me to put together this project, which I think and I hope people are going to be quite excited to see, well, the breadth of architecture, the breadth of corners of the Alps that a lot of people have never heard of. Yeah, these lonely, lovely little corners, which the Alps, they're so big. Anyway.
Well, there is, yeah, an enormous amount of climbing in the Alps, isn't there? Or mountains in the Alps, that we only focus on often the known places, when in fact, as you say, there are hundreds and hundreds of, perhaps thousands of bivy huts around the mountains.
Yeah, there's, so in Italy alone, there's over 600 bivouacs of these like unguarded, a bit like a Scottish Bothian, unguarded fixed refuge hut. And obviously one can make a very beautiful book using the same pretext, but using guarded refuges. But there's already kind of huts that do that, or books that do that, rather. I don't know quite why I'm fixated on the bivouac huts. I already had this fixation on little huts when I was in Scotland, and I probably visited, in the 7 or 8 years I lived in Scotland, visited probably 80% of the Bothies, of the kind of MBA Bothies back in the day, and took a lot of photos of them. And this was before the Bothy list became public. And so back then it was pretty tricky to find information on even where some of these huts were. And I guess that was there's a lot of geekery involved. Back then there was the kind of the quest for the information, and then some of them, like there was just no, you know, in the middle of the Cairngorms, there's a couple that there's like not even any paths going to them. And I guess then coming to the Alps, this kind of a renewed, it is quite geeky, this kind of quest to identify where all these huts are, and especially the kind of most interesting, because there's not much information. They're mostly marked on open source maps, but you don't know whether it's up to date, whether they are still there, what condition they're in, whether they're beautiful or not. And you know, and a bit of hunting on the internet, you get a little bit further. Then emailing the local Alpine Club, you get a bit more information, and little by little I kind of put a picture together of like, okay, well, these are the ones I really want to visit, because either they're quite new and architecturally interesting in and of themselves, or even if they're just one of these traditional little tin huts, but they're on a remarkable route in a remarkable place with a crazy view, or on a particularly attractive route, I've kind of narrowed it down to this, you know, a key list of ones I really, really have to visit.
So same in the Alps, as in same with the mountains of the Alps. You've done a huge amount of research to work out which mountains you'd like to go to, what routes you might take, what kind of process is involved with an example from Alpenglow, your first book then.
Yeah. So Alpenglow was trying to find the finest route on each of the 4,000 meter peaks, because there's already books on the normal routes of the 4,000 meter peaks, and the normal routes, a lot of them are very beautiful, but most of them are pretty busy. And so both for myself, I wanted to do not necessarily the normal routes, and then just because it'd be more interesting and photographically more interesting, and it leads to a more diverse selection of routes. And they kind of, I think they stand the test of time, as the list that I made. I recently climbed the Gabarou Marceny on the south face of the Bar d'Écrin. And I think if I'd climbed that earlier, then I would have put that in, because it's a pretty king line compared with the one I put on the north face of the Bar Noir. Is very beautiful, but the Gabarou Marceny is better.
One updated.
Yeah,
two. Very good.
But I guess the research for the 4,000 meter peaks, trying to find these like esoteric lines or beautiful lines or the best rock, it was reasonably easy, because there's a lot of information about the 4,000 meter peaks. You've just got to trawl and trawl and trawl and read and trawl and in several different languages. So, for instance, on the Obergavelhorn, actually, I could have put the North Face, I could have put the Arbengrat, I could have put even the normal route over the Valenkoop. They're all like outstanding routes. In the end, I chose the South Face because barely anyone climbs it, and I've climbed all the other routes, all the other kind of classic routes, and the South Face, we went and did it, and I was like, wow, it's actually quite remarkable. On a Swiss 4,000 meter peak, there aren't many big face climbs on decent rock, and it's not very hard. It's like grade 5 or something, but it's a spectacular line that I think is somewhat underrated, or barely anyone climbs it. And so I included it. I would have been able to include much more beautiful photos if I'd included the Arbon grass or any of the others, probably make easier photos. It's very hard to shoot on a kind of on a steep rock face when there's a storm coming in, which is what happened. But yeah, I thought it was, and it still stands for me, I think, as the most kind of interesting stroke esoteric way to climb the mountain.
Hmm. Well, it's a very justifiable answer. Hmm? It seems like all these things lead nicely to the next step. For example, the huge amount of research that you do allows you to discover different areas, and through curiosity, you want to go to these places to explore them. So naturally, you will go to a bivouac hut. That piques anyone's interest, a nice little refuge or shelter from the mountains. And then you take a beautiful line up the mountain. And of course, it's nice to bring back memories, these photos. As you say, they're very tangible connections to what you've just done. So I think it's quite nice how there is the big circle. I was going to sort of ask, well, which one feeds into which? But I think they all seem to feed into each.
Yeah, I guess. So the overarching theme over and above, the bivouacs are kind of... They were just me finding a structure, if you will. I remember when I was finishing Alpenglow, Rob Collister told me, he's a mountain guide and an alpinist and an author of several books. And I remember him saying, like, ooh, as I was getting towards the end of the process, he was helping me edit some of the text. He's like, watch out for when you get this to press, that you don't get postnatal depression. And he was bang on, because actually, once you've spending so many years invested in like a really like absorbing, passionate project, and coming out the back end of that, I was like, oh wow, what do I do now? What am I aiming towards? What am I working towards? So I actually, even before I finished, just as a kind of arbitrary objective, I put together a huge list of routes on 3,000 meter peaks. So I've got this spreadsheet with maybe like 400 lines on it of like routes that I'm gently picking away on the finest 3,000 meter peaks across the Alps. And I thought it might take another 5 years or so, but I see it's actually going to take another 20 years or so. So don't hold your breath for that. But in the meantime, I got already had a lot of shots of bivouacs and routes that are done to them. And I've been more focused on that recently. And it's, okay, I do love spending nights in little bivouac huts, and I'm fascinated by the architecture, but it is just a way of structuring my life, in a way. It's a way of giving me a meaning and a purpose, like any day of the week. If I can see on the weather forecast sunshine somewhere in the Alps, I've probably got something that I want to go and do there. So there's no kind of question. It's not like, oh, am I doing this Beastmaker session today or that one? Or I'm going to the Ortler, to the Giampiero bivouac, or I'm going to this. And I know that, you know, some of them end up with not so good photos. You know, some of them don't make the cut, but a lot of them, like most of them do. Most of the times I'll come back with some kind of photos of interest and a story I can write up. Some of them are very brief, like it'll be like, you know, just a 300 words description of the environment or the route or something. Some of them lead me down like rabbit holes, often about the history of First and Second World War, because a lot of these are on the French-Italian or Italian-Austrian front lines. And so, yeah, there's such a depth of cultural and political history in there that, like, you do one internet search and you just disappear down a rabbit hole of stories of what went on. And so I've totally lost the thread of what the question was, but these bivouacs are, yeah, they're kind of a structure just to hold my life together. And, you know, some of bivouacs are on or at the base of quite tricky routes that I want to do. And so, you know, so I will do my kilterboard session to get just about strong enough that you can winch me up something kind of tricky in the Dolomites, or on some steep ski line, or this, that, and the other. So, and you know, and if I get, you know, if Petzl or Mountain Equipment ask me to do some photos with you, I've got to have keep up to the level where I can keep up with you, and that, you know, and that's kind of nowadays a key problem for photographers and videographers. Half your job is keeping up with the athletes, and so both myself, I want to stay trained and fast enough to keep up with somebody who's an endurance athlete and strong enough that at least I can second up kind of what you want to do, maybe. Yeah, and all of these, you know, some of the time work will obviously divert me entirely from this, like, this passion project, and I'll go and do what I'm told to do and just pay the rent. But because this project is so diverse, I can usually kind of find a way of feeding everything, both my own training, my guiding work, photography work, and then free time, if that ever exists, into this project.
This project is obviously many, many different things, not necessarily one thing.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Arbitrary as it is, these little huts are the kind of framework that holds together all these dissociated things that I do, and yeah, the thread that runs through it, I guess, is stories, photojournalism, photo stories, and written stories. Hopefully in the end it will look rather less discontinuous when we send the book to the printers, and the kind of theme that runs through is these little huts, even if the adventures are fairly unconnected.
Mm-hmm. So we were saying earlier that perhaps if you take out or take away the things that we produce, let's say for you it could be photos or books, then what is left behind? If we put you on a desert island, what would you keep? Would you keep it the climbing? Would you keep the books? Would you keep the photography? Or do you like the fact that you've got everything? That's such a diverse 2 weeks, for example, that you gave. It must keep you very interested.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if I was on a desert island and the option was we have
a sect of
sayers, a Dolomitic peak, or my camera, whew, I know what you'd choose, but I kind of want my cake and eat it. I'd probably go for the north face of the Civetta. If the options were like sayers, Civetta, or my camera and the equipment needed to edit photos, I'd probably go for Civetta. But
you would be heartbroken when there's a beautiful ridge, beautiful light.
It'd be crushing. It would be really upsetting. It would be really upsetting, like, not to be able to put it together. But if there wasn't the peak or the cliff face, then there's no photos to take. So if it came down to it, then I would go for the mountains. The photos and the stories are just a way of me kind of making meaning out of life. In its essence, I will choose to spend time in the mountains, even if I haven't got a camera. I struggle to believe.
Let's come back into the room. That's okay. Yeah. Well, isn't it great that we can?
Yeah.
isn't it great that we can try and find meaning in all this life? I think the main thing is it's great that you do have all these activities. You don't have to choose.
Yeah, it's a pretty vibrant time. Back in the 1910s, just starting to have cameras, and just, yeah, I guess things haven't changed that much since the beginning of alpinism. There's, I guess, just the medium of storytelling has changed. In 1870, it was the Alpine Journal or the Alpine Journal. Now it's the Alpine Journal or the Adventure Journal or Sidetracked or a gazillion websites or TikTok, or it is a bit bewildering now. That's I wonder if I would have been better suited to the 1870s, because it's very tiring nowadays. You're kind of being dragged by this kind of there's so many threads of media environment tugging you in different ways. But I guess back in the 1870s, the only people that were doing it were aristocratic gentlemen, and so that wasn't going to happen for me. So I guess take it or leave it. Pretty good right now, huh?
Well, I'm very glad that you're here right now. That's excellent. Well, Ben, thank you very much, and that's all for now, I think. Should we leave it there?
Yeah, I think it's a bit rambling, but
think. Yeah, we went to many different places.
Yeah. But, it's tricky to keep a structured train of thought. Like, oh my God.
We went into a lot of places. Yeah. No, that was brilliant. Thank you very much. That was a really great insight. Well, thank you very much, Ben, for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.